From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Actor Martin Landau received Oscar nominations for his roles in Tucker and Crimes and Misdemeanors. And he gained fame for his longtime role on TV's Mission Impossible. On this edition of Fresh Air, Martin Landau talks about those roles, and he discusses the other part of his career, working with the Actors Studio, teaching actors like Jack Nicholson. Also today, poet Frank Bidart tells us how he uses other people's lives as a way to better understand himself. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new recordings by British conductor Roger Norrington. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Bird on a Wire, starring Mel Gibson and Goldie Hawn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The jury considering second-degree murder and other charges against Joseph Fama in the allegedly racially motivated slaying of black teenager Yusuf Hawkins has reached a verdict. Court officials said the announcement is being delayed so that police can be deployed to provide security in various parts of Brooklyn where the killing took place. The time of the jury's announcement has not been released. There was a breakthrough tonight in the Kremlin's two-month-old battle with Lithuania. Soviet President Gorbachev met for nearly 2 hours with the prime minister of the breakaway republic. Afterward, the prime minister called it a step toward opening negotiations on independence. Ann Cooper has more from Moscow.
Prime Minister Kazimier Prunskynia told Gorbachev that Lithuania's March 11th independence decree is not negotiable, but other acts taken after the decree can be suspended, she said. Gorbachev still says he wants Lithuania to freeze the decree itself, but the fact that he received Prunskynia and told her to come back when she's worked out legal details of a compromise suggests he's easing toward the negotiating table. Today's meeting came on the eve of talks between Gorbachev and Secretary of State James Baker. Baker's visit to the Kremlin tomorrow morning is likely to be more cordial now that Gorbachev has taken a conciliatory step on Baltic independence. After his talks with the Soviet president, Baker will meet with Prunskynia. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
President Bush emerged from a meeting with West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl today to voice his strongest support yet for a unified Germany. The president said that unification should end the Allies' post-war rights in Germany. Israeli President Chaim Herzog accused the Greek Orthodox Church of launching a defamatory campaign against Israel. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Israel and the Greek Orthodox Church have been very tense ever since a group of Jewish settlers moved into a hospice owned by the Greek Orthodox Church in Jerusalem's Christian Quarter last month. Today, Israeli President Chaim Herzog sent a letter to the New York-based Greek Orthodox primate for North and South America, charging that the church had launched an anti-Jewish campaign against Israel. He said that for the church to take a real estate transaction that it was a party to and use it as a basis for attacks was despicable. It was Israel's strongest assault on the Greek Orthodox Church since the incident began. Whether the settlers' lease was legal will be decided by the courts. Today, the court case was postponed for several months. Meanwhile, 20 settlers are allowed to remain in the building according to a Supreme Court decision. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Prices on the New York Stock Exchange resumed their rally today, pushing to a new record high. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 12 points to close at 2,831.71. Gains outpaced losses by an 8-7 margin. This is NPR News. The Pentagon announced today that it's reversing a long-standing policy of asking NATO allies to increase their defense budgets by 3% a year. The decision reflects the reduced threat of attack from the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact countries. The policy change was announced in advance of next week's meeting of NATO defense ministers in Brussels. The spending target was set in 1977 during the Carter administration. It was designed to coax NATO member nations to take up more of the burden of their own defense. Budget negotiations between the White House and Congress resume today. As NPR's Mara Liasson reports, not much progress is expected for a while.
Congressional negotiators who emerged from the second round of deficit reduction talks this afternoon said that the discussions are still preliminary. The negotiators have yet to determine exactly how much deficit reduction will be needed to meet next year's Graham-Rudman targets. Right now, there are two conflicting sets of numbers. The White House Office of Management and Budget predicts that between $59 and $74 billion will be needed to reach the targets. The Congressional Budget Office makes a much more gloomy prediction, saying $85 to $95 billion worth of cuts and/or tax increases are needed. And both these estimates exclude the cost of the savings and loan bailout, which many say is now mushrooming to almost double the amount Congress initially appropriated. The budget negotiators meet again on Tuesday. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
One of the co-defendants of deposed Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega was sentenced today to 30 months in prison for his part in a drug trafficking deal between Panama and Florida. Eduardo Pardo pleaded guilty in February to a single federal charge of transporting $800,000 in drug profits from Florida to Miami. Freed American hostage Robert Polhill underwent surgery today to remove a cancerous growth around his vocal cords. He was reported in good condition following a four-hour operation. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For 20 years, Martin Landau took many movie and TV roles that he didn't much like. When he finally got a challenging role as the businessman hustler Abe Carrots in Francis Ford Coppola's film Tucker, Landau was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. The next year, Woody Allen gave him a part in Crimes and Misdemeanors as a philandering husband who has his mistress murdered when she threatens to tell his wife about their affair. Again, Landau was nominated for an Academy Award. Now he's starring in the new HBO movie By Dawn's Early Light, which premieres this Saturday. He plays the President of the United States, who's trying to avert a full-scale nuclear war with the Soviet Union. Until recently, Landau was best known to the public for his role as a super spy in Mission Impossible. But among actors, he's known for his work with the Actors Studio. The Actors Studio was founded in the late 40s in New York by Ilya Kazan and Lee Strasberg, and has been the training ground for actors such as Marlon Brando, James Dean, Geraldine Page, and Robert De Niro. Landau joined in the early 50s.
That year, 2,000 people auditioned trying to get in, and two were accepted that year. Steve McQueen and I were the only two. And it was tough to get in. It's still tough to get in.
What did you have to do to get in?
Well, I did a scene, a five-minute scene with a partner, not classical, contemporary, a give-and-take scene. You can't do a monologue, and it's still the case. And I did a scene from a play called Clash by Night. Lee Strasberg actually directed it on Broadway with a cast consisting of Lee J. Cobb, Tallulah Bankhead, and Joseph Schildkraut. At any rate, I chose a five-minute scene from that piece. Everyone told me I was crazy because Lee had directed it, and they said there would be no way that he would agree with what I chose because of his closeness to that material. At any rate, the final audition was being judged by Alia Kazan, you know, who directed Streetcar Named Desire and on Broadway and in the movie and on the waterfront and East of Eden and many, many, many things. And Cheryl Crawford, who was a famous Broadway producer and one of the co-founders of the group theater, and Lee Strasberg. And you had to get 3-1 votes from all of them. 1, 2, or 3. 3 meant no, 2 meant not bad, come back another time, and 1 meant you were in. And I guess in retrospect it was a bit daring, but Strasberg gave me a 1 vote as well.
So it was you and Steve McQueen who got in of those 2,000 people who auditioned. Were you and Steve McQueen competitive with each other at all as the two newcomers?
Not really, no. Steve was very different physically than I was. I was very lean and very dark and much more ethnic in feel, and Steve was... I think he was much more competitive with a very close friend of mine called Jimmy Dean, James Dean. I was in a different sort of category. Johnny Cassavetes and Sidney Pollack and those kinds of fellows were my competition.
Mm-hmm. Now, you stuck with the Actors Studio as a teacher, right? I mean, when did you start?
Well, I was encouraged by Lee Strasberg to teach as a young actor, which he didn't do with a lot of people.
Oh.
And, you know, over the years, you know, Jack Nicholson had studied with me in the early
you taught him,
50s,
in other words,
early 60s.
He was
Jack
a
was my student for three
mm-hmm.
years, and Harry Dean Stanton and Warren Oates and Shirley Knight and Bruce Geller, who created Mission Impossible. Even recently, Oliver Stone worked with me as an actor about 10 years ago before he directed his first movie. He had already won the Academy Award as writer for Midnight Express, but he had been signed to direct a film, and the head of the studio, the head of production, called me and said, would it be okay if he came into my workshop as an actor?
You met a lot of actors before they had the screen personas that they're now famous for. For instance, Jack Nicholson, who had been one of your students. Would you have guessed, working with him early on, that he would have become, I don't mean as famous as he is, but that he would have had the kind of persona that we now know him for?
Yes, a lot of that was evident. I mean, it's silly to, to say that, but it's true. In choosing that particular group of people, there were 16 in all, I saw 200 people, and I spent my time not auditioning them, but talking to them and trying to discourage them from coming into my class, because what I did in the class demanded a certain kind of allegiance and diligence and tenacity and hard work. But I looked for things in the people, and Jack did all the right things wrong and all the wrong things right, which was what I always looked for. Strange. It's hard to say. It's sort of a kinesthetic thing. But I saw a lot of stuff in Jack. And he looked like the boy next door in those days, but there was nothing about the boy next door in his persona.
Martin Landau is my guest, and he stars in the new HBO movie By Dawn's Early Light. Knowing as many actors and directors as you did through the Actors Studio, how do you think that affected your early career, getting roles?
Well, I was always considered very offbeat in those days. I was
for
very,
what reasons?
Very thin.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was very thin,
mm-hmm.
Exceedingly thin. If you look at North by Northwest, you'll get a clue.
You were one of the spies in North by Northwest.
Well, James Mason and I played the two spies, and I was, but very, very lean and very kind of stark-looking. It was a period where places like Picnic were being done on Broadway, and movie actors looked more like Rock Hudson and Guy Madison and Tab Hunter. And I was, intrinsically a character actor, but not easy to cast because of a very, it was a different time. I mean, there were no, Al Pacino and Dustin Hoffman and Bobby De Niro would also have had a great deal of problem in those days because they would have been considered offbeat. But times change. And I wound up playing many, many bad guys in movies as a result of my looks.
Like what? Which kind of roles are you talking about? Which movies?
Well, all kinds, gangsters and the Untouchables. I would always be some kind of deadly guy, who would talk like this, very dangerous. And westerns. I mean, if you look at a picture like Nevada Smith, I play a demoniacal killer that Steve McQueen chases down because my character, along with Arthur Kennedy and Carl Malden, have killed his parents. That's the essence of that film that Henry Hathaway directed. Hitchcock cast me in North by Northwest, even though he saw me in a picture, in a play, that in which I didn't play a conventional bad guy, though I was the catalyst in the piece. It was Paddy Chayefsky's first play on Broadway called Middle of the Night. I toured with that, and that brought me to California, and Hitchcock saw me on opening night and had me in mind for North by Northwest as a result of that, though the character was 180 degrees different than the role I played in North by Northwest. So the old guys, I mean, the old, wonderful, imaginative fellows historically have always had imagination and broken conventional thinking. I mean, even as recently as my being cast in Tucker, I mean, I don't think there's anyone in the world who would have cast me in Tucker other than Fred Roos, who is Francis Coppola's producer, and Francis Coppola. It's not conventional, would not have been conventional thinking on anyone's part. In fact, there were people who, after they'd heard I'd been cast in that role, who were involved, were surprised at the casting. But
what would have surprised them about it? I mean, you fit the role so perfectly, seeing the movie.
Well, that's after the fact.
Right, that's after the fact. How was the role?
I mean,
role...
everyone is very quick to jump on
right.
After the fact in this world. And on the, immediately after playing Tucker, there were. Script after script after script with a lot of very ethnic, mostly Jewish, older men were sent my way. It takes a Woody Allen to think of me as the character I played in Crimes and Misdemeanors. Again, a departure from anything I'd ever done before and anything he'd seen me in before. But it takes those, you know, I'm an actor who's got a very wide range, I mean, much more so than almost anyone I know, in deference to myself. I'm not speaking, you know, egocentrically at all, but I do have a very wide range. I could play a lot of things. And it's hard for people, and logically hard and understandably hard for people to think of me for certain roles.
Let's stick to Tucker for a second. When
sure.
when you read the script for the character of Abe Carrots, the financier, what interested you in the character? And what did you want to bring out in the character?
Well, I just saw lots of layers there. I saw things that, you know, I hadn't had a good movie role in almost 20 years, and I've been waiting for one. I've been playing mindless heavies in empty-headed movies, you know, where if you brought too much dimension to the characters, it wouldn't help the movie. You know, they're action-adventure movies or horror movies or... And the kind, you know, the kind of character that wakes up in the morning and says, I'm a villain, that's what I do professionally, I'm going to be mean today. And that's, you know, there aren't really people like that. So those are very stylized and very ultimately frustrating, frustrating in the sense that those were one-dimensional characters and that's all I was getting. But I was somewhat frustrated, and my creativity was being thwarted, but I kept my, you know, sanity in a sense and waited for a good role. And when I read that script, it just jumped off the page and grabbed me and hugged me, and I just embraced it. And I knew that could be the role that could break through for me. So Coppola and I had an hour and a half meeting in which Francis thought, you know, in our early exchange at that meeting, felt I was too young and too tall. And I said, don't worry about it. We have 2 weeks of rehearsal. And during those 2 weeks, I got a little older and a little shorter every day.
How did you get older and shorter every day? Was it in the posture, stooping
Well,
over?
You have to look at Jeff Bridges and I are the same height. So check out the movie. It's hard to explain.
I was actually screening it again last night at home on video, and you're not standing up straight most of the time. Like, by the middle of your back, you're starting to stoop a little
bit. It's a certain kind of posture because of the certain kind of man he is.
Right, right.
See, I have a fine arts background, and I saw Abe in a particular way. So I drew the character, I think this kind of hairdo that I felt was period, and just out of my recollection when I was a kid, and the kind of mustache and the shape of it. And then with Milena Cananero, chose very carefully the suits. My character wears a lot of different suits, but they're all brown, excepting in one sequence where the cars unveil, where he wears gray, and it's a sort of a festive thing, which counters the, you know. They're all different brown suits. I just felt the character was brown and carefully chose the ties with Helena. And we sometimes would argue over things. So what I'm saying, basically, it was a collaboration. While I was working on the insides of the character, I was also working on the outsides of the character.
Mm-hmm. My guest is actor Martin Landau, and he received Academy Award nominations for Best Supporting Actor for his roles in Crimes and Misdemeanors and Tucker, and he's now starring in a new HBO movie called By Dawn's Early Light. He plays the President of the United States, is trying to avert a full-scale nuclear war with the Soviet Union. The movie premieres this Saturday on HBO. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actor Martin Landau is my guest. You have received Academy Award nominations both for Tucker and for your role in Woody Allen's movie, Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Yes.
Now, you had told us that it was like 20 years since you'd gotten like a really good movie role.
That's right.
How did you feel to like in the mind of the public, you know, and some people in Hollywood, to kind of go overnight from being the guy who played the heavy all the time in movies to suddenly being this, you know, venerated actor.
Well, it's you know, the interesting thing is, I mean, among actors over the years, I've always had a great deal of respect from them as a director, as an actor, as a...
As a teacher.
So, I mean, it's something that they've always said to me, what's wrong with the business? You know, I mean, I know a number of actors, for instance, personally, who should be doing much more work than they are doing because they're awfully good. But I work with a lot of the great directors when I first came to Hollywood with a reputation as a good New York actor, theater actor, live television actor. So that seemed to have been curtailed by my quote-unquote success on Mission Impossible, where suddenly I became super spy and, you know...
So you feel in a way that Mission Impossible hurt your career?
Well, it helped
afterwards.
Me in many ways, mm-hmm. and it hurt me in other ways. Yeah. But I think there are always, when somebody gives you something for a headache, there are sometimes side effects. You get an upset stomach.
Right.
I got a chance to play almost a one-man rep company, everything from Adolf Hitler to Martin Bormann, to myself, blonde and young, 10 years younger, to all kinds of different dialects and accents and the like, you know. And the Middle European people and crazy, all kinds of things, if you know what I'm saying, my dear.
You were the master of disguises on the show.
That's right, a man of a thousand faces.
Let me ask you about Crimes and Misdemeanors, and this movie's about to come out on videotape.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I think it's going to be released the 24th of May, just on next week.
Did Woody Allen or one of his people call you and say, we want you for the role, or did you have to audition for it?
No, what happened was I got a call. Saying that Woody was interested in me for a role. And I said, well, is there a script? And which was greeted with laughter on the other side of the telephone because, I mean, Woody doesn't, you know. I mean, most of the time the actors don't read the whole script. No one reads the whole script except Woody and maybe Mia and the casting director. So, but I was then told that it would be worth my while to fly into New York, so I did. But prior to it, I also went out and did a little homework because I... reading a script and seeing a movie are two different experiences. So I went out to Samuel French, which is a theatrical bookstore here in Los Angeles and New York as well, and got eight of his screenplays. So when I met with Woody and we talked, he then gave me the script, which was unusual, I found out afterwards, to read in the hotel room, which I did. So it was the ninth screenplay of Woody's that I read in 4 days, and it was the best one. And it was one of those times when your heart starts beating faster and adrenaline starts flowing. First of all, it was the biggest male role he'd ever written outside of the Woody Allen character because his protagonists generally have been women. Diane Keaton, Mia Farrow, even recently Jenna Rollins, mm-hmm. Geraldine Page, and Interiors. So he'd never really written a big male character that wasn't played by Woody.
Why did he feel that you... needed to read the whole script?
Because there was no way to play that character without knowing everything about that movie because of the delicacy of it. I mean, it's incredibly delicate thing. You're dealing with a man who's a rich brat of a man, who's a liar, who's a cheat, who's an embezzler, who's a murderer, who's... I mean, it is not a redeeming thing he does, and yet the audience has to, you know, from my point of view, and this is what I expressed to Woody, has to empathize and sympathize and join up with him as they're being horrified by what he does. I felt it was essential that the audience see themselves in this character, and that the only way to do that, I mean, the character doesn't do one single thing of redemption in the entire movie. He's an awful person. And I, you know, you could, in this clicker mentality we're living in, where people click things off television in 15 or 20 minutes, it'd be very easy for the audience to say, hey, this guy's a jerk. I don't like him. And you don't have a movie. So how to delicately deal with that, and also, you know, the Claire Bloom character.
Who plays your wife.
Yes, but she doesn't know what it's a very delicate thing. I mean, she knows I'm having some problems, but she doesn't know the degree to which the problems are. I mean, there's a man who's having a major breakdown, a nervous breakdown, on top of the fact that he does something that is among the most heinous things a quote-unquote leading character has ever done.
So does Claire Bloom, when you were acting with Claire Bloom, had she not read the part of the script where it's revealed that you were a murderer?
Parts of the script.
So she had no idea what you were really guilty of. She knew something was up. She had no idea what when she was acting.
Well, she just knew that I was, you know, having some business problems, possibly.
Do you think this works? Do you think this is a good way to go about
Well, it depends. It works with Woody, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't want Angelica to know what kind of life my home life was, because I don't let her in on that. So Angelica's character was not privy to that part of the story. Joanna Gleason, who plays Woody's wife in the film, felt it was a very good way to go because it gave her enormous freedom. She felt she could do anything within that. She understood the relationship, but she didn't know what else was going on in the movie, and that Woody would ask for something if she, in fact, wasn't giving it. You know, a lot of times actors are bogged down by obligation. An actor knows much more about a character than the character knows about himself. And to know everything there is about a character consciously may not enable you to play the character necessarily. It's what motivates you unconsciously that drives you on. Characters reveal things inadvertently very often, not purposefully. No one walks into a crowded room at a cocktail party filled with strangers and says, "Hello, everybody, I'm embarrassed." You know, that's not something people do. Therefore, what people in that condition are trying to do is trying to convince themselves they're relaxed and trying to appear relaxed to other people when, in fact, what's going on is contrary to that. So the actor has to create the degree of unrest and then try to cover it.
What was Woody Allen's style of directing you?
Giving me a lot of freedom. But then he's good directors know that, well, Martin Ritt, who's a friend of mine, has, I'm sure other people have said it, but I've heard Marty say that 90% of directing is casting. And if you cast the right people, open the door and let them go. If you cast the wrong people, you're going to try and make a giraffe out of an elephant. I mean, it's impossible. So Francis, too, Coppola as well. I mean, Francis, I walk up to Francis and I'd say, "Francis, I can play this scene 10 different ways." And he'd look at me, he'd say, "Pick the best one," and walk away. So, Hitchcock, all of the good ones really give you a great deal of room to create. That's why you've got the part. I mean, that you're going to bring stuff to it. I mean, no one can tell you what to do. I mean, you're in a sense helping them, and they in turn are helping you to illuminate what's there. And if you understand it, and you can play with it and explore and.
Now that you've proven your talent and versatility.
Well, I don't know if I've proven it. I'm working at it.
Right. Well, are you getting the kinds of roles offered to you on a more frequent basis than you have before? I mean, what's happening?
Absolutely. I'm getting great things offered me. And my big dilemma at the moment is to decide what to do so that I can do several of these good ones, because a lot of them overlap. And what I'm trying to do at the moment is make it work so I can do a couple of them as opposed to just one of them.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Martin Landau, and he was nominated for Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for his roles in Crimes and Misdemeanors and Tucker. He plays the President of the United States in a new HBO movie called By Dawn's Early Light, which premieres this Saturday. Crimes and Misdemeanors will come out on video next week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the international arms business. Who's selling weapons? Who's buying them? And what does it mean for the future of war and terrorism? My guest will be the defense correspondent of the Sunday Times of London, James Adams. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Frank Bidart reads an excerpt of his acclaimed poem, Ellen West, about an anorexic woman. Bidart is a poet and teacher who has profoundly influenced the work of many other poets. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new recordings by British conductor Roger Norrington. Norrington uses period instruments to play post-Baroque music, and Lloyd says Norrington's skill makes this music from old instruments sound thoroughly modern. And guest film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews the new action comedy, Bird on a Wire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A jury in Brooklyn, New York, has found Joseph Fama guilty of second-degree murder by depraved indifference in the Bensonhurst racial slaying of Yusuf Hawkins. Fama was the accused trigger man in the shooting death last summer. Reporter Julie Cohen is outside the courthouse in Brooklyn, and she describes the scene.
Security is extremely tight. The reaction, it was a very emotional scene when the verdicts came down. Two of the jurors were shaking and crying as the forewoman read the verdict. The family of Yusuf Hawkins all had their arms linked around each other and were sort of hugging each other with every reading of a guilty verdict.
That's reporter Julie Cohen in Brooklyn, New York. A second jury is still deliberating the fate of 19-year-old Keith Mondello, accused of inciting his friends to take up baseball bats and attack Hawkins when he ventured into Bensonhurst with three friends to look at a used car. In Washington, given what the Pentagon today called changes in European security requirements, the U.S. is no longer asking NATO allies to increase defense budget by 3% a year. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
The 3% spending target was set more than a decade ago in order to get the other allies to share the defense burden in Europe. Few ever met the target. And today's announcement is an acknowledgement the threat from the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact has diminished, and that the 3% increase is neither needed or viable in the new climate. The announcement comes 2 weeks before the president meets with Soviet leader Gorbachev, who may take comfort from this since his own alliance is in shreds. Both President Bush and German Chancellor Kohl in Washington for a visit said that in the new Europe, NATO should reevaluate itself, concentrating on the political, not the military, role. When NATO leaders meet in London in early July, they'll have to determine just what this means. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Also in Washington, President Bush has called for a unified Germany with full control over all its territory and said today that unification should end completely the post-war rights of the Allies in Germany. The president met today with West German Chancellor Kohl. Britain, France, and the United States support West Germany's call for a unified Germany to be part of NATO, but the Soviet Union argues that the new Germany should be neutral or a member of both NATO and the Warsaw Pact. East German lawmakers have given themselves the right to make constitutional changes that are necessary for a merger with West Germany. Today's action was necessary for approval of a treaty on economic and social unification that the two Germanies are scheduled to sign tomorrow. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed at another record high of 2,831.71. The Dow Industrials moved up 12 points in active trading of some 165 million shares. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. British conductor Roger Norrington has been a pioneer in the use of historical instruments in performances of not-so-early music. His complete set of Beethoven symphonies last year was a great success. Now Angel Records has released two albums of music from even deeper into the 19th century. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
The use of historical instruments has finally entered the musical mainstream. There are now conductors like Roger Norrington and John Elliott Gardner who are not merely using gut strings and valveless horns, but who have real ideas about music. And the music they're playing is no longer confined to the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, and the Baroque period. Norrington's latest recordings are of such central repertory figures as Schubert, Schumann, Mendelssohn, Berlioz, and Wagner. There are two new discs, and they're both impressive and delightful. The first is an album of early Romantic overtures, which include such staples as Mendelssohn's Hebrides or Fingal's Cave overture, which he apparently composed before he actually saw the famous Scottish tourist attraction. There are also overtures to Weber's Oberon and Wagner's The Flying Dutchman in its exciting original version. The album also includes a couple of less frequently performed but marvelous pieces, like Berlioz's fascinating overture to an opera that he never completed about a Westphalian secret court, Les Francs Juges, which has some splendidly sinister and rhythmically unsettling brass and percussion. There's Schumann's darkly moving overture to his opera Genoveva. Yes, Schumann wrote an opera. My favorite is a joyous, irresistibly tuneful Schubert overture to a melodrama called Die Zauberharfe, The Magic Harp, but you won't hear any harps. Norrington and his original instrument orchestra, the London Classical Players, give brilliant, exuberant performances of all of these overtures. They revel in the fresh, crisp timbres of the old instruments, which end up sounding paradoxically modern. Listening in stereo to the historic seating arrangements of the musicians is another pleasure. You can hear the second violins on the right answering the first violins on the left, the way the composers intended. Norrington likes sharp accents and brisk tempos. His performances are always in the fast lane, and that keeps them buoyant and exhilarating. In Schubert's great C major symphony, however, I think there's more going on than the youthful energy that Norrington emphasizes. He makes strong musicological justifications for his interpretation, but finally I miss the oases of repose, the spaciousness, not just the slowness, that allows non-historically oriented conductors like Klemperer, Furtwängler, and Celibidache to be more searching and heartfelt. In comparison, Norrington seems to be rushing. The sublime trio of the scherzo movement, for instance, sounds more military than rustic. Thank you. Still, Norrington always gives us something new to think about, to argue with. My only worry is that he seems to have virtually the same slant on everything. He's smart and enormously gifted. It's great that he's expanding his repertory. Now I'd like to see him expand his view of music, too.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. This weekend at the Emerson Studio Theater in Boston, Lloyd will direct the premiere of These People, Voices for the Stage. It's an adaptation of his first book of poems. This is Fresh Air. We first learned about poet Frank Bidart from two trusted sources, Lloyd Schwartz and Mark Halliday. Lloyd reviews classical music for Fresh Air, but he's also a poet and writing teacher. He met Bidart when they were both graduate students at Harvard. Lloyd told me he thinks Bidart is the most trusted personal critic of people's poems. There's a network of poets who wouldn't consider a poem finished until Bidart read it. Mark Halliday is Fresh Air's poet in residence. Mark studied with Bidart at Brandeis. Mark says, as a teacher of poetry, Bidart revealed a kind of courage to live by, the courage to insist on truthfulness at the heart of one's own poems and those of others. Bidart currently teaches at Wellesley and Brandeis and serves as the literary executor for the estate of Robert Lowell. Bidart has a new book called In the Western Night, Collected Poems, 1965 through 1990. I asked him to explain how he first found his own voice as a poet.
At a certain point, you realize that all you're doing is a sort of a pale reflection of what's been accomplished. And then you turn to your own life and you ask yourself, well, does Ulysses describe my life? Is life studies the embodiment of my relationship, my experience, what it felt like for me to grow up? And, well, the answer is no.
Well, you've been working with the subject matter of your life and the lives of others. You've also been working with tone of voice, with trying to get mm-hmm. the voice down. And I think your poems have a real sense of I in them. It's not just like a third-person description. It's not description. It's an I telling somebody and working through something, trying to get to the bottom of something.
I know I felt again and again that the only way I could really make a poem that I wanted to make was if I tackle something from the bottom up, or tried to do something which got to the bottom of an issue. It's only satisfying, I think, if you at least attempt that. Otherwise, you're sort of floating around in, in how I feel today, or in describing what it looks like out the window. That's not very satisfying. It certainly doesn't answer to what one's soul wants art to be.
You know, in addition to writing about your life in your voice, you've also written about other people's lives in their voices. Why did you start doing that? Was there a need to kind of get out of your own life, or kind of get beyond your own experience in your writing?
Well, I think when one reads, when one comes upon certain material, you discover yourself in it. I mean, when I was an undergraduate, I read The Case of Ellen West, mm-hmm. An essay, a great essay by a man named Ludwig Binswanger. Anyway, the essay and The Case of Ellen West I felt very compelled by. I felt I very much recognized powerful, important elements of my own experience in her. She's anorexic. I've never been anorexic, but I grew up a Catholic. The issues of the kind of war between the mind and the body were very real to me. I had always been overweight. I was never exactly fat, but I was too heavy, and I hated being too heavy. I felt that to write a poem about her was to find a purchase on issues not only about weight and the relation between mind and body, but issues about gender that I had no other purchase on, and issues that, for whatever reason, I couldn't seem to write about in my own voice.
Could you read us a section from the Ellen West poem?
Okay. Well, this is early in the poem, and she's talking about a time before she was in the hospital, before she was married. About 5 years ago, I was in a restaurant, eating alone with a book. I was not married, and often did that. I turned down dinner invitations so I could eat alone. I'd allow myself 2 pieces of bread with butter at the beginning and 3 scoops of vanilla ice cream at the end. Sitting there alone with a book, both in the book and out of it, waited on, idly watching people. When an attractive young man and woman, both elegantly dressed, sat next to me, she was beautiful, with sharp, clear features, a good bone structure. If she took her makeup off in front of you, rubbing cold cream again and again across her skin, she still would be beautiful, more beautiful. And he, I couldn't remember when I'd seen a man so attractive. I didn't know why. He was almost a male version of her. I had the sudden mad notion that I wanted to be his lover. Were they married? Were they lovers? They didn't wear wedding rings. Their behavior was circumspect. They discussed politics. They didn't touch. How could I discover? Then, when the first course arrived, I noticed the way each held his fork out for the other to taste what he had ordered. They did this again and again, with pleased looks, indulgent smiles for each course, more than once for each dish. Much too much for just friends. Their behavior somehow sickened me. The way each gladly put the food the other had offered into his mouth. I knew what they were. I knew they slept together. An immense depression came over me. I knew I could never, with such ease, allow another to put food into my mouth. Happily myself put food into another's mouth. I knew that to become a wife, I would have to give up my ideal.
This poem is based on a case study. How did you change the case study into a poem? And what did you take from it? And what did you transform?
Right. I think I couldn't have written the poem if I felt all I was doing was simply replicating the case study. And there would have been no point in simply repeating what was already there.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a long time reading the case history, read it very slowly and certainly more than once. And like Ellen West, I like to go to restaurants and sit there and read a book and brood. I was in a restaurant one night, and I said to myself, I want to imagine how Ellen West would feel sitting here. It was quite amazing. A couple came in, sat next to me, at the table next to me, and they started doing the things that I describe in the poem. In other words, the section was really a kind of gift from nowhere. It's incredible. They didn't just, you know, have a couple of bites from each other's plate. They really fed each other. And as I was watching them, trying to be in the skin of Ellen West, I felt her sense of revulsion at this, the way this embodied the intimacy of their relationship, something about the nature of marriage having to do with being willing to give food to others and to accept food from others, and the sort of terrible sense that if this was what relationship and intimacy and marriage was about, forever barred from it.
What's the longest you've ever worked on a poem?
Well, the last poem in this new collected poems is called The First Hour of the Night, and it took me about 3.5 years to write it. It's something I mean, a lot of that time was brooding and thinking and reading. That's the longest it's ever taken me to write a poem.
That seems like a really long time. Now, I know that there have been long periods in your life where you don't answer the telephone. Is that is that work-related or is that personal?
Oh,
or are the two so intertwined it's hard to
separate? You have spies,
yes.
who have told you lies. No, it's all too true. I love to hole up in my apartment and think and read and brood and listen to music and watch videotapes. And I'm never lonely. Solitude for me is not at all lonely. I resent the idea that anybody with a dime can invade one's privacy. I mean, that's silly, obviously, because it's not only an invasion. And when I get lonely, I call people on the phone, and I certainly see people, and I like social life very much. But I like it a lot more when I have also had a lot of time to be alone.
Are you working on a poem now?
No, I haven't written a poem since the book was finished, which was the end of last summer. In a way, it's a wonderful feeling not to have to write. That is, I felt something was completed with the book. Some project was completed. I have a lot of other ideas about what a new project will be, but I don't know... I certainly don't know what the embodiment will be, and I don't feel driven to enter it yet. It's a very nice feeling. It'll end too soon. Of course, I also hope it'll end too soon. If it goes on too long, I'm going to be in a panic because I'm not writing.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Okay, it's really been a pleasure.
Frank Bidart, his new book, In the Western Night, Collected Poems, 1965 to 1990, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, today a report from Moscow, Terry, about talks between President Mikhail Gorbachev and Prime Minister Prunskina of Lithuania. You know, the Lithuanian parliament yesterday rescinded or at least delayed the effect of certain laws taking force. And that action was seen as meeting some of Moscow's demands. It now may be that talks are underway that could resolve the crisis over Lithuanian independence, not to mention Estonian and Latvian independence as well. Also, you're familiar with ramps?
There's some kind of plant that people eat, but I've never seen or eaten one.
That's right. Well, we will, in a way, see people eat them in West Virginia. Noah Adams' visit to a ramp supper tonight.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. After a very slow month, Hollywood is beginning to unload its batch of summer movies. Guest film critic Owen Gleiberman has a review of what's being presented as the season's first, Bird on a Wire.
Is it possible to make a movie that's nothing but the sum of its own marketing devices? On the surface, Bird on a Wire has all the trappings of a good night out. It's a romantic road comedy in the tradition of It Happened One Night. It features the redoubtable star pairing of Mel Gibson and Goldie Hawn. And it was directed by John Badham, whose credits include Saturday Night Fever and the lively Richard Dreyfuss comedy Stakeout. You'd think these people would have it in them to keep us entertained for a couple of hours. But Bird on a Wire is a strangely dull experience. The film isn't just formulaic. It's shamelessly, oppressively formulaic, the movie equivalent of the generic section in your local supermarket. Gibson and Hawn play former free spirits who had a brief fling in Mexico when they were hippies. Mel is now an auto mechanic who's been living under the Federal Witness Protection Program for 15 years. It seems he testified against a couple of corrupt drug enforcement agents. As for Goldie, she's a corporate lawyer. Yes, a yuppie who's turned her back on her counterculture past. When a ludicrous coincidence throws these two together, they end up on the run from Mel's old enemies. And that's when the bickering starts.
All right, now who's going to pay for this hotel room?
Well, they need a chambermaid.
A chambermaid?
Yeah, well, I'll help you. It's only 12 units, and won't take us very long. What? What? Are you mumbling? What are you doing?
I said good luck, pal. I'm out of here in the morning.
Mary Ann, I gave this guy my word.
Well, I didn't, all right? I'm going to call my office in the morning and have them express mail some money. I'm going to pay this guy off. I'm going to buy this damn place if necessary. And I'm out of here.
Hey, calm down, Linda. What's eating you?
Calm down. I just took a shower with a cockroach from hell. He's in there doing his hair right now. Not to mention the fact that you've sold me into human bondage.
The dialogue in this movie sounds like it was fed through a screwball comedy processor. It's enough to make you long for Neil Simon. But have no fear. Just when you're growing tired of machine-tooled wisecracks, Badham will be sure to throw in a really raucous car chase.
Oh, you gotta break my damn legs! Will you stop that squealing?
For contrast, there's an airplane chase. And let's not forget the motorbike chase, and also many, many shootouts featuring the sort of high-tech weapons that look like they could reduce Midtown Manhattan to Beirut in about 15 minutes. Through it all, we're kept on the edge of our seats by such suspenseful questions as, will Mel and Goldie really get back together? Will they defeat those awful, nasty bad guys? And will Goldie ever grow tired of the dithering sexpot routine she's been rehashing ever since Laugh-In? By the end, we're supposed to understand that Mel and Goldie haven't just triumphed over their adversaries. They've rediscovered the spirit of the 60s. That's so the movie can give you that feel-good feeling. Bird on a Wire is far from inept, but that's exactly what's depressing about it. Badham has created a piece of state-of-the-art tedium. When a talented director reaches this level of soulless craftsmanship, who's to say whether he's working out of boredom or cynicism? Badham used to entertain. Now he packages. And movies like Bird on a Wire are helping create a culture that doesn't know the difference.
Owen Globerman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Audrey Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we hear about arms dealers, new weapons, and the new arms race. From journalist James Adams. He's defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. Also, we meet actor Tim Robbins. He played a dim-witted pitcher in the movie Bull Durham. Now he co-stars with Robin Williams in the new film Cadillac Man. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.